From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Trump's consolation tour. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. In the aftermath of disaster, the President of the United States is traditionally the uniter-in-chief, but Donald Trump is often called the divider. His administration stepped up after hurricanes hit Texas and Florida. Today, he's mourning victims of the mass shooting in Las Vegas. But yesterday in Puerto Rico, he continued to minimize the damage and loss of life after Hurricane Maria devastated the home of 3.4 million American citizens. On our program today, are officials keeping the death toll artificially low? Why has the U.S. military been so late to arrive? Later on our talking point, Scott Pruitt, head of the Trump EPA, is asking for lawsuits. That's according to a Republican who formerly held his job. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Trump showered sympathy and resources on Texas and Florida after they were struck by hurricanes, but it's not been like that for Puerto Rico, which may have been hit even worse. We'll hear about the rising death toll and the delay in military assistance. Today's talking point, EPA Director Scott Pruitt has met often with oil companies, coal miners, and automakers, but not so much with environmentalists, public health advocates, or even his own staff. William Riley, who led the EPA during the first Bush administration, says that could get Pruitt in trouble. First, this news update. It's been reported that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has considered leaving his job because of disagreements with President Trump. Today, Tillerson held a special news conference about his tenure.
To address a few specifics that have been erroneously reported this morning, the Vice President has never had to persuade me to remain as Secretary of State because I have never considered leaving this post.
Susan Glasser is Chief International Affairs Correspondent with Politico. Welcome to our program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So people, including the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, have called upon Tillerson to resign. It's more than just idle rumors. Why have they done that?
Well, a couple of reasons. I spoke with Richard Haass, the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is not a normal thing, needless to say. It's a pretty staid establishment group. He is making the point that it goes two ways. Number one, of course, Donald Trump has undercut the Secretary of State and potentially reduced his ability to affect any diplomacy in the world, right? When the president tweets, as he did the other day, "Give up, Rex. There's no point in diplomacy with North Korea." It really tells the world that Rex Tillerson doesn't speak for the president, doesn't speak for the United States in a way that makes it very hard for him to do his job, number one. Number two, there's been an enormous backlash here inside the State Department at the way in which Tillerson has been running it, the cuts, the very insular team that he's assembled there, the lack of consultation, and of course the lack of clarity around just what their foreign policy is. That press conference this morning was a pretty amazing spectacle. Usually in Washington, when you have to throw a press conference to say, no, I'm not quitting, and you're asked if you called your boss a moron, you're not necessarily going to last very long in the job.
What did he say when he was asked to be called his boss a moron?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because, interestingly, he didn't deny it. And that is as good of a confirmation as you'll get in this town. I think it's very notable. Obviously, a lot of people think the reason he didn't specifically deny it is because he said it in the presence of so many people that it would be foolish to go further. Now, actually, NBC updated that. The story said he called Trump a moron. Later, the reporter went on air and said, actually, no, he called him an effing moron. You know, clearly there was a real conflict that had erupted between President Trump and his Secretary of State, and it's been clear for months that this was not really a good fit.
Speaking of clarity in policy, Tillerson was asked about reports that President Trump will tell Congress that the Iran nuclear deal is not in America's interest, even though Iran is complying with its provisions. Now, here's what the Secretary of State had to say.
So it is an important part of that, but it is not the only part. And I've said many times, we cannot let the Iranian relationship be defined solely by that nuclear agreement.
Susan Glasser, how do you take that?
Well, you know, this is a big Washington debate that's playing out right now. Donald Trump has a deadline of October 15th to once again certify to Congress that Iran is in compliance with the terms of the nuclear deal. As you know, he gave his speech at the United Nations General Assembly just a little bit more than a week ago and made it very clear what he thinks of the Iran deal, the worst deal ever, an embarrassment to the United States. He's told his advisors he wants to blow it up. Rex Tillerson is disagreeing with Donald Trump privately behind the scenes, and now increasingly publicly, so has Jim Mattis, in that they've both said that it's in the national interest of the United States that we keep the Iran deal. So now they're trying to split the difference and come up with this awkward policy. It looks like what they are recommending is that Donald Trump not certify that Iran is in compliance, but then hopefully not have Congress do anything to impose further sanctions. And so you have this incredibly kind of convoluted policy, which comes in a way from Donald Trump having boxed in his own team by his public statements.
You mentioned Jim Mattis, the former general, who, of course, is the Secretary of Defense. Is he as much opposed to the president on this issue as the Secretary of State?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Just yesterday, there was another pretty dramatic moment. These days in Washington, as you can tell, there's more than one a day. But yesterday, the Secretary of Defense went up to Capitol Hill to testify, and he was asked point blank by a senator whether he believed that Iran deal was in the national interest of the United States. And he sort of took this long pause, and he looked down, and then he looked back up, and he said, "Yes, Senator, yes, I do believe it." And, you know, basically came out and publicly supported Rex Tillerson at a time when Trump has not. Again, he left the room open for this possible policy maneuver where they're going to sort of say, well, we're not certifying, but we're also not blowing up the deal. It's not clear that will work. It's a very complicated scenario.
Okay. Susan Glasser, once again, Chief International Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Very vivid accounts of what's going on in the Trump administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In a moment, in the aftermath of disasters, is President Trump the uniter-in-chief or the divider? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. The mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, has recently put President Trump on the defensive, claiming that federal aid in the aftermath of Hurricane Marina has been too slow in coming. When he visited yesterday, the president seemed to minimize the damage and loss of life since Hurricane Marina devastated the island.
Every death is a horror, but if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands.
But after the president left the island, the official death count was more than doubled from 16 to 34. For days, though, Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism has reported it's much higher than that, while officials have denied it. Earlier today, reporter Omaya Sosa Pascual told me that downplaying the crisis might be designed to comfort people who haven't connected yet with their loved ones.
You know, maybe it's not to alarm those people. Maybe it's not to keep the morale as up as they can. Or maybe it's just to look good in front of the federal government, which actually I think totally backfired, because if you wanted to look like you were having an effective response, well, that's where President Trump's comment comes in. So, you know, maybe you don't need that much help, because things are not that bad here.
Do you think they might be trying to avoid criticism from President Trump?
You know, that's a possibility. That's a possibility. And also, they started with that number, and it became Trump's number, too, because before he arrived yesterday, President Trump was already using that number to defend his response in Puerto Rico. So, you know, to start saying something different would be to publicly contradict the president, I guess. But I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. But certainly I know they know this is not, the number was not right. They've known for a long time now. A cabinet member of the governor, the secretary of health, admitted this to me last Monday of last week. Our story came out on Wednesday of last week with him saying that he himself had already counted seven more, and those seven more were not in the 16 official count. And that was last Monday of last week. So I can only speculate as to why they were doing this.
So now it's officially up to 34. Do you think there really are hundreds of people dead on the island?
I think, yes. Yes. I myself have counted about 60 with all my sources, and I've touched only maybe six municipalities of the 78 municipalities with individual sources of myself. So, yes, I think it should be in the hundreds.
Not to in any way denigrate what happened in Las Vegas, but President Trump's attitude there, where he is now meeting privately with the victims at a local Las Vegas hospital, has been very, very different from what it was yesterday in Puerto Rico. He has said it's a very sad thing. We're going to pay our respects and to see the police, who've done really a fantastic job in a very short time. We may have a soundbite from the president before our program is over. But once again, it's a very different kind of attitude, different expression than we heard yesterday in Puerto Rico, where Armando Valdez Prieto is a lawyer. He's based in San Juan. He's former director of Puerto Rico's Office of Management and Budget. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
How do you take the difference in tone and attitude and approach by the president to what happened in Texas and Florida and what happened in Las Vegas?
Well, I don't know if it's fair of me to say it in this way, but I think that a lot of people in Puerto Rico, and myself included, feel that President Trump is treating certain U.S. citizens who have the right to vote for him, in other words, residents of Texas and Florida and now in Nevada, as first-class citizens, and treating Puerto Ricans who, according to our political relationship with the United States, if we live here in Puerto Rico, we do not have the right to vote for the U.S. president, as second-class citizens or perhaps even third-class citizens. And again, I don't know if it's fair to say that, but it's certainly the feeling. Comparing how he has dealt with victims of those prior two hurricanes, in the case of Texas and Florida, and of this tragic loss of life in Nevada, with how he treated victims here in Puerto Rico.
Very quickly, a very brief history lesson, if you will. How is it that people in Puerto Rico, such as yourself, are in fact citizens of the United States, but not able to vote for president? Aren't you, in fact, in some sense, real sense, legal sense, second-class citizens?
Well, 1898, Puerto Rico is ceded to the U.S. By Spain after the Spanish-American War. 1917, we become U.S. citizens. In March of that year, prior to the entry of the U.S. into World War I in April of 1917, this year we actually celebrated 100 years of U.S. citizenship. And then, you know, throughout the years and in that history, we've gained in self-government. In 1948, we were able to elect the first Puerto Rican governor elected by the people of Puerto Rico. 1952, we get our own constitution. But that has all required certain compromises in terms of political representation in the U.S. We don't pay federal taxes, but we don't get
We seem to have lost the connection for a moment here with Armando Valdez Prieto in Puerto Rico. It is not a place where communications are easy by any means, and perhaps that's no surprise. We'll try to get him back. First, though, we do have him back. So go ahead, finish your point. The phone just went out. No, apparently he is not back. There you are.
I'm here. I didn't hear the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was simply, again, about the change, and you were going into the history of Puerto Ricans as over a long period of time, finally getting to vote for your own government, but still not being able to vote for president of the United States. Yet again, you are citizens in that respect, of course. You are equal to all the protections of the
U.S. citizens.
Constitution.
Correct. We are U.S. citizens and, of course, worthy, I think, of respect and of the aid that is required at this point to save lives now and to rebuild Puerto Rico into the future.
What about the 89 hospitals on the island? It's my understanding from talking to Amaya Sosa Pascual that many of them haven't even been reached yet, and that, in fact, it may be that their morgues are full of people who are deceased, and that the number may go way up. Why do you think there's apparently an effort by the officials in Puerto Rico to downplay the damage?
I don't know, and I agree with Amaya. I heard.
Once again, we're having trouble with the transmission. I'm sorry that you just went out. We'll try to correct it as we go along. But other questions have arisen in this context, and one of them is, how much does the president know, how much do Americans know about what is going on in Puerto Rico? We have seen recently polls indicating that some 54% of Americans did not know that the people in Puerto Rico are, in fact, citizens of the United States. Alvin Chang is a data reporter at Vox, and he's been looking at the coverage of Puerto Rico by different outlets. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Warren.
Tell us what you found and how you would contrast what's going on Fox News as opposed to other sources of information.
So in the week after the hurricane, 538 did an excellent analysis finding that that media, all media, online and cable, just were dismal at covering the Puerto Rico travesty here. And we found that, or they found that, compared to the two previous hurricanes that hit Texas and Florida, we just didn't cover it to nearly the same levels. And so I kind of broke it down and saw, you know, how did we respond to this? How did we kind of needed to respond with more coverage, putting more focus on there? And one of the things I found was that there's one network in particular that continued to neglect Puerto Rico. That network, of course, is Fox News. And this is significant because Fox News provides is the main source of news for 40% of Trump voters. It's, you know, perhaps the main source of news for President Trump. There's evidence that the hosts see themselves as advising President Trump. So all of that combined means that we have a portrayal of reality that might not be accurate, and that a huge portion of this country might be getting, including our president.
So, again, when Fox News has covered, how much what has the nature of the coverage been? What have they emphasized?
So what they don't emphasize is the struggle for the resource crisis, shortage of water, fuel, electricity. That's what a lot of the other networks have been focusing on, kind of the human toll. Fox News has almost entirely neglected that portion. It doesn't mean they haven't covered it. There's, you know, I know Geraldo Rivera is in Puerto Rico and has covered this quite a bit. It's just saying that looking at the entire mass of coverage from the past week, the proportions are just way off. What they do talk about and have talked about is what President Trump has actually done. Things like tweeting about Puerto Rico, that's been something they talked about extensively because that caused a bit of drama. Things about the Puerto Rican or the San Juan mayor, which San Juan mayor and the President Trump had went into kind of a dramatic tiff of sorts when President Trump waived the Jones Act, or when President Trump said, we've made tremendous strides. Those are things that Fox News has covered. It makes it seem like we're making a lot more progress than we actually are when, you know, as we know, there's still a lot to be done there.
Jones Act, of course, allows or prohibits foreign vessels from landing at American ports in certain circumstances, has to be lifted for that to happen. And there was a long delay before the Jones Act was, in fact, lifted by the Trump administration. Let me introduce Tim Naftali. He's a presidential historian and also a clinical professor at NYU. He was formerly the director of the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda. That's here in Southern California. Welcome back to our program, Tim Naftali.
Thanks, Warren. Glad to be here.
The president, generally speaking, is sort of the comforter-in-chief. We saw when he was in Puerto Rico the president tossing paper towels to victims and smiling and saying, everything's been going great. You ought to be proud of how this is being handled. He said that he'd made up with the mayor of San Juan, although she wasn't allowed to speak. How does that reflect what presidents generally do as compared to the way the president has behaved as far as Texas and Florida and now Las Vegas are concerned?
Well, it was really peculiar for a leader of our country to try to comfort people by telling them that their natural disaster was not as bad as one that had happened a decade, more than a decade earlier, hundreds of miles away. The president's approach to Puerto Rico, I think it's fair to say, his rhetorical approach has been different from that he used regarding Harvey and Irma, Florida and Texas, and that has raised some real questions. He got very political about it. He was very defensive about it. He began to talk about Puerto Rico's budget and debt problem, which seemed an odd thing to be raising in the middle of a real catastrophe on the island. And so that has led a number of people to say that this is an example of him being a divider in chief. His tone was very different regarding Puerto Rico. There's no question about it. And he remains very defensive.
As you just described, he did make a comment about the budget. Here it is.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
I believe we have Armando Valdez Prieto back with us. How did that comment go down in Puerto Rico?
Well, it didn't go down well. The truth of the matter is that he would not, I think, have dared say something like that about Florida, Texas, or even Nevada. I think it's irrelevant to the human toll that is being exacted right now because of this natural disaster in Puerto Rico.
Professor Naftali, again, a presidential historian, what about Puerto Rico? And have other presidents been dismissive of that place and its interests, even though the people who live there are citizens?
Well, I honestly don't know in detail, but I cannot imagine any previous president telling any American citizen that the catastrophe that they saw develop and that they experienced was somehow were lucky that it could have been so much worse. And gee whiz, didn't we do a great job in helping you? Most presidents say, we're doing our best. We'd like to do more. We're going to try to do better. Most presidents will say that because they recognize that there's no way for the federal government to provide immediate assistance to every single citizen who is affected by a natural catastrophe. It's just not possible. It'll take time. And so you want to create some patience and concern and understanding. He didn't do that.
Okay, Tim Naftali. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. We'll talk about how much worse it might actually be in Puerto Rico. On our talking point later, Scott Pruitt, head of the Trump EPA, is asking for lawsuits, according to a Republican who held that job in the past. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Once again, Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism has reported a death toll from Hurricanes Irma and Maria, particularly Maria, that could vastly exceed the current official toll of 34 people. That's up from 16 since the president was there yesterday, more than double. One reason, apparently, according to our reporter Omaya Sosa Pascual with the center, could be that many people have buried relatives for public health reasons.
We keep hearing those stories. The Secretary of Health himself told me for the record that he was informed of a family in the West that had to dig a family grave, or that he was told they had to do that. It's very difficult to get to those actual families and to get their names, because it's a felony to bury somebody here. They haven't issued like an emergency order. So when I did my investigation, the public officer in charge of that just said that people cannot bury anybody without the proper legal process, that will be a crime. So you may imagine nobody wants to actually come forward and say, I had to do that. But we keep hearing those stories, and it's a fact that at least three sisters in the center of the island were buried in a mudslide for at least a week before they could take out those bodies. The government has recognized those three sisters already.
It must be that many days after people have died, their bodies have deteriorated and they become a public health problem, don't they?
Of course. That was my question all the time to the government, and it seems like they just don't want to talk about the issue because, you know, it's impossible to ask a person who is in an incommunicated place, which they recognize day after day, that there are places where they still have not been able to get to, the government has not been able to get to. How can you ask a person to have a body in their house, in the living room, sitting for days? That's unreasonable.
Let me go back to Armando Valdez Prieto, once again a lawyer in Puerto Rico and former director of the Office of Management and Budget in that country. How concerned are you about people outside of San Juan, where you live and where President Trump says things look pretty good to him?
Well, I think I'm concerned, and I think a lot of people in Puerto Rico are very concerned. Now, I have not been able to go very far outside of San Juan myself. I've been to Caguas, Gurabo, where I grew up, Levittown, Puerto Rico. And certainly things are worse when you get out of San Juan. How much worse they are in, for example, the central region of the island, which is very mountainous, very difficult terrain, not a lot of big roads to get trucks in. It has to be worse. And again, not surprising what Omaya is pointing out about not just the death toll, but how people must be dealing with a dead relative who you can't get to a funeral home because, you know, roads aren't there and possibly the funeral home's not open.
And there's talk that with 89 hospitals, I believe 69 perhaps, in the territory, that there may be morgues in hospitals that have not been gotten to yet, where in fact bodies are being stored.
That I know of as a fact. I've actually visited some hospitals, and I know of people who died, actually not during the storm or because of the storm, but before the storm, who are still in a hospital morgue because they have not been able, the family has not been able to reach out to a funeral home that's open that can take the body. And so that I know for a fact. The morgues at the hospitals, and of course the morgues at hospitals aren't designed for that, are piling up and filling up with not just people who died because of the storm, but also people who died just before the storm.
Okay, another issue that's been raised is the slowness of the military to arrive and provide help in Puerto Rico. It took a long time just to appoint somebody to be in charge of that effort. And that has been the subject of reporting by Richard Parker, who's based in Austin, Texas. He's also author of Lone Star Nation, How Texas Will Transform America. But he's also been reporting for Politico about the military response. They were all geared up, I take it, and responded very quickly in Texas and in Florida. Richard Parker, welcome to our program. What happened after that?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, the response to Harvey was massive. Within just a couple of days, the military had mobilized C-17s, C-130s, search and rescue. We're talking about dozens upon dozens of military helicopters bringing in supplies and stuff by air, and also evacuating people to a military hospital in San Antonio. Within days, there were 17,000 members of the armed forces, you know, in and around. And what's interesting about Harvey and Houston is the area impacted geographically in terms of population is quite similar to that of Puerto Rico. There were huge forces on standby for Irma, and most of them, with the exception of a very small amphibious ready group, seem to have been turned off right before landfall.
Now, when you say turned off, what do you mean exactly? And are you suggesting then that they could have gotten to Puerto Rico much sooner than in fact they did?
Yes. The plan for Irma involved establishing a significant air bridge, which is the technical term for continual flow of large cargo aircraft, bringing in, they could brought in supplies, fuel, medicine, food, whatever. They had been ready to move 17 million tons, I believe, of supplies during Irma. The 101st Airborne, their aviation unit, put all of its or most of its helicopters into aircraft ready to support operations in Florida. The Navy dispatched a carrier and a small task force to the Keys. So those forces were all ready to go. The helicopters were unloaded, however, it appears right before landfall. And the Navy ships turned back to port, with the exception of this very small amphibious ready group, which was already offshore in Dominica and the Virgin Islands helping out there.
So instead of going to Puerto Rico, they went home. Then did they have to turn around and go back to Puerto Rico?
No. The USS Abraham Lincoln, which is a Nimitz-class carrier, arrived in home port on September 15th in Virginia, and I don't see that it has ever left. And we've used carriers in operations in Haiti, which was very successful. We had a carrier on station in Haiti within 3 days of their earthquake back in 2010, if memory serves. And we used airlift to evacuate about 15,000 Americans. So we have a lot of experience doing this all around the world, as well as, you know, along the hurricane zone of the Gulf Coast.
Let me turn back to Tim Naftali, our presidential historian, formerly with the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda. Is there any way to account for this, or does it just appear that there was a mistake of some kind?
Well, Mr. Parker's given some really interesting information. FEMA has issued a chronology, and if you read the website for both NORTHCOM, that's Northern Command, and SOUTHCOM, Southern Command, you get a sense that there was a division of responsibility. And I would like, when there's time, once the people of Puerto Rico have gotten all the assistance they need, and the leadership there can pull things together working with the federal government, I think there will have to be an investigation. Why was Northern Command in charge of Puerto Rico and Southern Command in charge of the U.S. Virgin Islands and Dominica? They are two different commands with two different headquarters. Why was there a shift in the approach to the whole problem on the 27th of September, which is clear from what's come out of the U.S. military? Apparently, their whole strategy changed. It appears that behind the scenes in the first days after the hurricane hit Puerto Rico, the U.S. government was debating what to do. And I don't know why, given the history of our, you know, there was a way to deal with this. We'd already seen it with Harvey. We'd seen it with Irma. And as Mr. Parker mentioned, we'd seen it in dealing with Haiti. So why the confusion? Why the debate? To what extent was the president himself involved? To what extent was he distracted? We don't know that yet, but I hope we will learn.
Richard Parker, I'm assuming you've attempted to find out. Have you gotten any answers when you ask that kind of question?
I have not been successful, I have to confess, Warren. I think that there's going to be some, this is an opinion, I have not reported this, but I do think that there's going to be some serious buck passing. In the end, according to the military manuals that I've read, because if the military wants you to do something, they will give you a manual. The civilian authorities, in this case FEMA, as your guest just said, is supposed to sketch out what their needs are, what capabilities they need. They don't have to designate what kind of vessel or aircraft or whatever. That's the military's job to do that. So there appear to be only a couple of possibilities, logically speaking. One is FEMA and the civilian authorities did not quickly and adequately communicate what was going to be needed, despite, as the professor just said, 4 days warning time that a Category 5 was going to hit the island directly. Secondly, if there's any plausible excuse, it is that we have a lot of crises going on all over the world at this point. And many of these assets are considered strategic assets, such as airlift, and maybe because of Korea, the thinking was that the military couldn't really dedicate all that right now. But it doesn't stand to reason, really, with the Lincoln and home port, and many of these aircraft just sort of turned down. So it's going to be important, I think, at the end, exactly as said, you got to sort out the human misery and costs right now to get to the bottom of it, because it has not been a by the books operation just based on the manuals themselves.
Very quickly, if you can, you reported this on Politico. The Defense Department keeps track of what gets reported and what doesn't. Have you had any challenge from the Pentagon?
Absolutely none. And I used to be a Pentagon reporter, and they will let you know if you made a mistake or if they don't like it.
I have to go back to Armando Valdez Prieto in Puerto Rico. Again, you were head of the Office of Management and Budget there. What's your take on what happened with the military? You're on the other end of this.
Well, I think it's inexcusable. I think history needs to be clear, and it needs to be made clear now so that, in a couple of weeks, things aren't distorted by other alternative facts. 48 to 72 hours before the storm hit, most of the credible meteorological models had the storm either passing so close that it was irrelevant whether or not it would make landfall or actually making landfall. The European model, which has been the most accurate model recently predicting the path of hurricanes, had the storm coming over Puerto Rico. And so the military and the U.S. government had enough time, 48 to 72 hours out from the actual event, to plan for an adequate response. And the fact that they did not, frankly, is criminal.
Tim Naftali, back to you again, a presidential historian. You said earlier that it's very important to investigate and find out what happened, according to the report by Richard Parker. Is this the sort of thing that can really be damaging to a president, not only in his own term, but in the long term as well?
Well, if Congress seriously investigates this, then the president's tweets during the crisis that everything was going well will harm him. As we're learning, however, there is a group of Americans who will stick to this president and defend him regardless. But those in the middle, those uncertain, those who just want our president to be successful, this may add to their concerns about his leadership. The question, of course, is whether Congress will do this kind of investigation. One hopes that it does.
How important do you think it is that Fox News has covered Puerto Rico considerably less than its competitors when it speaks to something like 40% of those people who support President Trump?
Well, I think it's really important that the stovepiping that we have in our society, the fact that we seem to be learning information from one group, that given that state of affairs, when one very significant network doesn't cover the story, and we're not talking about bias here, we're talking about not covering it at all, then there are many Americans, if they rely on that source for their information, many Americans will not understand why people are concerned about Puerto Rico and may actually think that this concern is partisan. And if that's what occurs, then they won't understand that that the president let down American citizens. They'll see all of this as some kind of democratic effort to discredit Donald Trump, when in fact it's a question of fairness to fellow citizens in Puerto Rico.
Again, Alvin Chang with Vox has left us, but what he said was not that they didn't cover it at all, but that they covered it very, very significantly less than their competitors, just a couple of hours in a period of 2 weeks, which is not very much. Again, Tim Naftali is a presidential historian, formerly a director of the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, now clinical professor at NYU. Thanks so much for being on our program. Thanks to Richard Parker in Austin, again, a reporter for Politico, also author of Lone Star Nation, How Texas Will Transform America. Thanks, of course, to Armando Valdez Prieto in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, its former director of Office of Management and Budget, a lawyer, political strategist there, and our guest on our recorded guest, Umaya Sosa Pascual, with the Center for Investigative Journalism. We were able to get a line with her and get her reports about what the death toll might actually be, as opposed to the official count of just 34. Thank you all very much for being on our program. In a moment, President Trump's EPA director may be in trouble, may see himself in court. We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alney here with today's talking point. President Trump's top environmental official is dining with leaders of the industries he's supposed to regulate and whose interests he served as Attorney General of Oklahoma when he went into court and sued the EPA, the agency he now leads. That's according to a 320-page accounting of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's daily schedule obtained by a Freedom of Information request. What else does it reveal? William Riley was administrator of the EPA for President George H.W. Bush. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Tell us, if you will, what you make out of the reports that have come out so far. They've been denounced by the EPA as efforts to make the EPA look bad.
Well, my impression is that the reports are simply repeat the calendar data that has been revealed as a consequence of American Oversight's Freedom of Information Act request. It's not something that I've seen EPA contest. They question the motives of the New York Times to play it up to the degree they have, but I think the facts stand apparently uncontested.
What facts do you think ought to be revealed, and what do they tell you?
Well, my own calendar was obtained every morning by various interest groups, press groups. On Monday morning, my calendar for the week was obtained and obviously scrutinized by people who thought they might have something pending before the agency, or you could often get an impression of what was coming up by the briefings that were scheduled and people I was meeting with and that sort of thing. And that's been true for quite a while at EPA. It was established some time ago by Bill Ruckelshaus when he took over after a very difficult period and the departure of an administrator who is much more circumspect and secretive about her behavior. And he established what was called a fishbowl rule. That has been something that, to my knowledge, has been honored consistently until this administration. But this administrator did not release his calendar. It took a Freedom of Information Act action to get it. And that in itself, I thought, was one more break with tradition from the past there.
Is there anything really surprising about this, given what we know about Scott Pruitt when he was the Attorney General of Oklahoma? He did, in fact, sue the agency he now leads, and he did it pretty much in order to give a voice to the industries.
Well, you know, I've never met Scott Pruitt. I've seen him at his confirmation hearing. He appears to be a very informed and very bright figure. I frankly would have thought it just tactically unwise not to have a broader outreach to the various constituencies that are involved with EPA matters, if for no other reason than he needs to know how they think. Some of these groups, I look back at the Environmental Defense Fund, they were critical in the actual design of the Bush Clean Air Act amendments of 1991. You need to know what these people think, and you will find out what they think when you issue a rule or regulation that has been largely shaped by your industry and your their advisors to you and what they argue with you. If you don't hear the other side, you will hear it when it comes time for them to sue you in court. I think something like 4/5 of the decisions I made, any controversial ones, went right into court. So I think that's not been smart. On a more important level, it seems to me that someone who comes to the agency with a background of having been so pro-industry and to the point of using their language in letters and complaints to EPA and then in the lawsuits that it filed against EPA, I think would be wise to bend over backwards to establish an aura of judiciousness now and impartiality. The job he has now is, in some respects, really it's the environmental conscience of the country that resides at EPA. And you want to know that it's fair. One of the important positions, responsibilities of the administrator is to communicate clearly, objectively, with integrity, and cause people to trust judgments about science, health, economics, and the rest. That's not happening.
We're talking with William Riley, who was administrator of the EPA under President George H.W. Bush, the first of the two presidents from that family. So what is he risking? And if, in fact, his actions are the subject of lawsuits, will that necessarily hold up those actions? And will that work, I would assume, to the disadvantage of Mr. Pruitt and what he wants to get done?
Well, there is no hard and fast rule that one has to consult everybody or even proportionally people associated with industry or with health, for example. However, in the crafting of regulations, the Administrative Procedures Act is very demanding. It requires that comment be accepted on a proposed rule or regulation, that those comments, for which a significant amount of time is often provided, sometimes more than a year if it's a very complex area with a significant economic impact, for example, those comments are reviewed, and they have to be answered. If a particular recommendation by a reasonable group has been made, one has to explain why it's not accepted if it's not. Then, finally, a final rule is issued. And it's supposed to reflect that process of extensive consultation and acceptance of views. Now, these can be obtained, and mostly are obtained, not just in hearings but in or private meetings, but in submissions. So he will get a chance to look at them. But I don't think that the sense that a large group of people who represent a strong commitment to the environment are being excluded, which it appears they essentially are, I don't think that's healthy certainly for the agency or the country, and I don't think it's good for the administrator's reputation.
You said the EPA is essentially the environmental conscience of the country. The current EPA responding to the issues raised by the New York Times by printing this schedule says that the EPA has been the poster child for environmental overreach. That's been said by a lot of people in your party for quite a long time. What do you say to it?
Well, the party's often had a problem with regulation. It's in the nature of regulation and of EPA that I used to think that if the president doesn't hear all of the good things that are being done by the broader population, for the broader population, he hears from the industry that's affected and the place where costs are increased. One has to understand that's the nature of the game, that we're protecting the environment, the public health, natural systems and the rest. And I think it goes with the territory that, and plays very well, obviously, in some places, that it's a time for deregulation. There are statutes, there are regulations that really do deserve revisiting. But, you know, one has to ask, frankly, would you trust this administration and this administrator to undertake an objective review of those measures? Even those of us who would encourage rethinking some of it would have the sense that we've yet to see an aggressive pro-environment position that extends the effort or the authority or the outlay to protect a vital resource. We've yet to see that once in this administration.
Are you worried about public health, about protection of specific parts of the environment that might not happen?
Yes, I am. I'm concerned, for example, about the methane rule that addresses a very severe contribution to climate change, to global warming, and to which substantial industry support, certainly among some of the majors, has been available for some time. The key major oil industries have been accepting that methane releases associated with fracking, for example, and drilling have to be cut down, and they recognize also it's product. This is something that can be sold. There's a lot of reasons to do it, but mostly for its effect on the climate. My understanding is that that is not something that EPA now considers that it intends to regulate.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's about as much time as we have. I take it that if, in fact, methane is released and not regulated, as you indicated earlier, public health is at risk. And I want to thank you very much for being here, making those points, and making yourself available. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be here.
All right. William K. Riley, once again, a former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency under the presidency of George H.W. Bush. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.